Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Kevin Mackin.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Foolish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And I must say, I met Gus Hiddink up in Malaysia when I was up there for the Sultan Aslan Shah Cup. And we were talking about his time with the Socceroos. And he was saying how what a special group of players he had then. And they should have gone further in the tournament at the World Cup than they did. And he said it was still very painful, that penalty given against them. But yeah, he goes, sometimes referees give those. He goes, but then when you complain, they make it up in another game, which was an interesting comment. Anyway, we've got a great show lined up for you today. And we're going to have, as usual, our special guest today, though, is a guy called Sam Goodwin. And Sam is the regional director for CSM. Sport and Entertainment. That is a marketing company, and we thought we'd talk to him about the marketing of sport, because obviously now there's so many options for sports and teams to try and market their product. It's very difficult to know what the best option is. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And John, am I starting us off this time?
You can go right ahead.
Okay, look, I'm going to start off with something, and I know I'm going to be accused of probably having a pop at something, as I always do. I did have a couple of ladies a bit upset with some of my comments on the last show.
What? About what?
They said that women's sport, it shouldn't be called women's sport. I'm going, well, you call junior sport, why? It should just be sport, was their feeling, and we shouldn't be differentiating.
I understand why.
I understand it as well, yeah.
You know how hard that makes it for doing the sort of thing you do? Because if you just say, for instance, hockey, people don't know whether you're talking about...
Yeah, and especially if the men's and the women's team are called the same thing.
Yeah.
So if you have, like, Newcastle United women, Newcastle United men, they're just Newcastle United, suddenly you've got to read halfway down and you go, Newcastle United beat Leeds 3-0, and you're going, is that the men's competition or is it the women's?
Well, yeah, so you get Spain women playing Argentina women and Spain men playing Argentina men, as we do in the Pro League on any given day. Argentina beat Spain 2-1 and then Argentina beat Spain 6-0. So you've got to have some differentiation there somewhere.
Yeah.
Anyway,
the criticism wasn't too bad, so I survived that one. But I know I'm going to cop this one.
You just bought them a box of chocolates, didn't you?
No, I didn't bother with that.
So now you're going to get a complaint.
No. What I want to bring up, John, is, and I think we've seen a lot of sporting associations and sporting bodies have seen that there is money to be made by making coaches become qualified or attend coaching courses. Mm. Now, we know that the FFA, for example, here in Australia, said when they came in that they wanted, you know, football had always been coached by mums and dads and ex-players, and they said they had to upskill these coaches and give them qualifications, which I think there was merit in that. But what we're seeing now, to me, or it concerns me, and it's not just in football, I think we're seeing it also in other sports. For example, there was a coaching course up at the Sultan Aslan Shah Cup for Asian coaches in hockey. And I just worry what we're doing is we're just churning out coaches. So we're churning out quantity rather than quality. Now, are there any checks in place to make sure that those coaches, once they've finished those courses, are actually going on and doing a good job? Now, I mention this because I was talking to someone from Germany, and it was saying that they'd done the German FA had done exactly the same. They said now they have probably three times as many coaches as there are coaching jobs. And they said, but of course, what you're having now is everybody, because they've got a qualification and they've paid to get that qualification, they then want paying to do the coaching. And whereas before, when mums and dads and ex-players did it because they loved the game and they tended not to ask for it, you know, the ex-player might have a couple of beers behind the bar for free or whatever. And they said, but now you're putting pressure on these clubs that, A, some of the clubs will pay for that, but then because the coach has got the qualification, he expects a job, and then he expects to be paid for that job, or she as well. We shouldn't just say he, because it is women as well doing it. And I'm just concerned that we're going down a very, very dangerous path where we're just firing out coaches. Now, I mean, there was a stat I remember years ago about lawyers, that Australia, for example, the universities were turning out so many lawyers that it used to be that I think Australia had one lawyer for every 300 people. And it's suddenly now it's down to less than that. And they said, if we go at the rate we are turning them out of universities in this country, I think it was by 2050, there would be one lawyer for every 25 people. If the population stayed the same. Now, that's terrifying, but I think we're getting the same disproportionate number of qualified coaches who are not necessarily the best coaches. Because again, talking to people who've been on these courses, they're going, very rarely are the people running these courses failing people, except at the very highest level. So when you're going for a pro league license or your top, top level to be, you know, the elite coaches, that's the only time you see the failures. Because at the lower level, people, they want the money and they're thinking, well, so-and-so's paid $1,500. We can't really fail them. And they've given up their spare time, so we should probably pass them. And I just worry about that. And I look at hockey, for example, in that Aslan Shah, they run these courses pretty much every year. Yet I look at, has the quality of coaching, and I don't know overall in Asia, you know, at the lower levels, but you look at how many top coaches have we seen in hockey in Asia. You know, Korea have brought back Shin Seok-kyu, and you go, well, you know, he did well, they won the Aslan Shah Cup, but then you had Harendra Singh, Cedric D'Souza, name another top Indian coach that's been successful. MK Kaushik maybe one. Then if you go into Malaysia, Stephen Van Heusen is probably the most renowned there. But then below that, what is there? You know, like, who are the other ones? And I just wonder whether we're producing quantity rather than quality. That's my question.
Well, look, let's face it. There needs to be some sort of training resource or whatever you might want to call it for coaching. I think it's a good idea that you do run coaching courses, that people who want to know more about coaching can go along to a coaching course and discover more about coaching and improve themselves, etc., etc. My issue comes with that when sports demand that the only way you can be a coach is by going through one of their coaching courses, because I believe it breeds an orthodoxy within coaching that is actually the antithesis of what good coaching is about. So that's one problem I have. Another problem I have is that you can't teach a good coach to be a good coach. Because the things that make up a good coach, what are the top level of any sport, is stuff like man management. And you can sit in front of a PowerPoint presentation and hear all the intricacies of, you know, of man management. But some people have got it and some people ain't. And you can look at a textbook for hours on end and you're still not going to get it if you don't have it. And it's those individualistic things about people that can't be taught, that can't be translated, that are what makes them really, really good coaches.
Now, I agree 100% with what you're saying. Now, there was an article I remember I shared on Not the Footy Show on Facebook where this gentleman had written about the reason coaching courses started was for the sharing of information.
Yeah.
Because he goes, there was no internet back then. He goes, but now, do you really need them? Because he goes, now you can contact any good coaches, you can contact them through Twitter, through Instagram, through Facebook, if you want to discuss something with them. And if you look, Ron Smith, you know, who was a great coach at the IAS for the football program there, he has, you know, people constantly having chats online with people about coaching issues, and is very generous to share his knowledge. And it was saying, though, on this course, it goes, like, seriously, what are you learning that you don't already know? You know, like, most of it is you just want to fine tune it, or you want to have a discussion with another coach and go, exactly what you're saying, you know, sharing information and going, well, you know what the qualities are, you need to be able to communicate, you know the structures of a game, but you kind of want to get the gloss to make yourself a better coach by just getting more information, gleaning information from others. And I think, as you say, that orthodoxy is what they're being taught, and you're not getting those pearls of information that are turning, you know, good coaches into diamond coaches.
And I think that there's different sorts of coaches. I mean, kids need a certain level of coaching, especially skills coaching. They need people that can translate, you know, how to hit, how to trap, how to push. The real simple basic stuff is what real young kids need. That's, and as they get older, they can start learning about, you know, other tactics, positioning, yeah, all that other sorts of stuff. So just because you're really good at teaching kids how to hit isn't going to make you really good at dealing with a 25-year-old international player.
Yeah.
And some people are meant to only be coaching at that level. Yeah.
And there are some outstanding junior coaches.
Oh,
because,
yeah.
You know, to keep a kid interested, to make it fun, enjoyable, exactly, that they want to be down there. And I mean, I'm going to mention, because I know a lot of people know Mark Lee, who I've seen, I think, is one of the best in the business that there is going around. But, you know, in WA, certainly, because he just has an enthusiasm himself that is infectious to all the kids. But there are others out there that are just as good, but there are some that are not as good. And like you say, it's like immediately assuming that an ex-player is going to be a great coach. Some of them are absolutely dreadful, and some of them don't actually know how they did the things they did because it came so naturally to them.
Yeah. One of the other problems I have with it too is when you formalise coaching and make it a prerequisite, you immediately disenfranchise a lot of people who could potentially be doing coaching but aren't going to because they don't really want to follow a coaching pathway. They don't want to make coaching their life. They want to be helping out their kids on a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday morning. They've got knowledge that they can impart, but they're not allowed to because they haven't paid the $150 to go to a coaching course.
A little bit more than that.
Yeah, well, whatever it happens to be. And a lot of people are turned off by that, that would make tremendous coaches.
Well, we've seen that a lot in sport here. I know in WA, a lot of the good football coaches that were ex-players that came over here, and they didn't have the qualifications, but they had a passion for it. Some of them are still doing it, but they're no longer allowed to be called the coach. You know, and that to me is really sad. And there are others who've, again, just walked away from the game because they now have this restriction that they must have this qualification to be able to coach. And as you say, I think it's kind of sad because some of the best coaches aren't necessarily people that want to sit in a classroom, fill in a form and satisfy a criteria.
And as important as coaching is, I sometimes look at international hockey and just think, this is so overcoached. The coach has actually got too much influence. I'm not here to watch that person coach. I'm here to watch a contest. And, you know, the introduction of quarters to hockey has made a dramatic effect on the influence of coaches. They've already got rolling substitutions. They can drag a person off at any time, give them a message and send them back out there. But now they have to get out there at quarter time. No, you guys aren't capable of playing for longer than 15 minutes without me putting my gob in there and telling you what to do. And that really irritates me because coaching should stop the second the game starts. Let the players play.
Well, the one that gets me, and I find this really sad, is when you hear players who are told that they're not allowed to back themselves in a game when an opportunity arises and that they have to stick to the game plan that they've had. Now, I know a certain coach of the Western Force was very strict on that, and I was talking to the players and they said, you know, I said, surely if you see a gap and you can get through that gap, you should go for it. And he goes, no. He goes, if we do that, we're really told off because we just have to stick to the phases that we're playing. And that, to me, is completely wrong because when I buy a ticket to go and watch a sporting event, I want to see those moments of magic where a player backs himself.
Absolutely. On that point, when we have these discussions about coaching, etc., they're very much focused on the top level. And let's face it, most people, A, aren't going to coach at the top level. What's the percentage of coaches at any sport at international level? Bloody small. Most players are never going to play at that elite level either. Yet that's where all the focus is about. You've got to develop it to be this. I can tell you right now, there's a big difference between being the coach of a team that's got a whole lot of people signed up to contracts that enforce them to be at training, enforce them to do all this sort of stuff, and he's the boss, and then going back down, say, three or four levels and having a team that's made up of guys that just turn up and try and get to training when they can fit it around work commitments and, you know, they've got the kid they've got to pick up on after school or whatever, who they're not following the strict regime that a coach might want to put into place. They're not there just because they want to represent Australia. They're there because they want to play the game. And they don't want a coach telling them, oh, well, you can't do this and you can't do that. We're going to work to this strict system. I tell you what, in the lower grades, that goes out the window. You don't last long at all. It's a totally different mindset to how you have to manipulate and what you can and can't coach that particular group. You can try and get them to play a style of hockey. I think the biggest thing a coach can do at the lower levels is pick players in their right position. That's the hardest thing, trying to get people in the place where their particular skill set is most going to help the team.
Then
players will revolt against that too. Oh, well, I don't want to play left half. I want to go and play right wing because I want to score goals. Well,
and you'll get some of them will just do that.
Yeah, but the art is talking these guys around into this, the common goal. it's a lot different than coaching at the top level.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I just wonder whether you do get that in a classroom. Again, that's my question. You know, I just think there's just, I don't know. I'm just a bit cynical towards it. And I think it's very much a money making exercise. And I just really do wonder now how much most of the people are getting out of it.
I've got no problem. I understand why orthodoxies exist, and I think there's a there's a genuine good reason. There's got to be some sort of orthodoxy, but when orthodoxy becomes the only way, that's when you're in trouble, and that's what's happening with coaching. There's only this way to do it from the point of view of the administrators. Coaches know that that's not true, but administrators are saying, you've got to do it like this, and this is our course, and we're telling you how to do it. And that kills coaching.
Well, that's a good time to stop, I think, and move on to our guest on this show.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Yes, you're indeed listening to a podcast of Not The Footy Show, and it's time for our guest on this show. And as I mentioned, the world of marketing of sport has become a really complicated one, because there are just so many options for not only sporting teams but sporting bodies to try and get it right in order to promote their sport or their sporting team. So we thought we'd try and go to one of the experts in this field. And CSM is a marketing company that specializes in sports marketing. And we caught up with Sam Goodwin, who's the regional director based in Sydney. Well, Sam Goodwin, welcome to Not The Footy Show.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here. Or not.
Well, I hope it's going to be a pleasure, because we've got a pretty big topic to talk about, and that is obviously the marketing of sport. Now, I understand that that's a sort of challenge on so many levels, depending on what level of sport you're going to play. And do you feel, I suppose, first up, that this market has really changed now with the sort of dawn of social media, that now it's become a lot more complex than it was in yesteryear?
Absolutely. I think the advent of the social sort of side of things, and beyond that as well, now with even more digital channels coming online in terms of different ways to market things through through things like Netflix and so on and so forth, it's basically just meant there are so many more channels for sports to market itself through. And all of those are valid, and all of those have different sort of reaches, and they all touch slightly different audiences. So it's become a very complex landscape for a sport to negotiate their way through. And it's no longer necessarily the case that just, you know, prime time domestic TV viewership is king anymore. You know, there's a lot more other ideas out there.
I mean, probably you've touched on their television, and let's maybe deal with that first up. And again, that in itself can be a sort of complex thing, because you see some sports, they get the TV deal that brings them in the dollars, and they almost rely then that the TV station is going to do all the marketing.
Yeah, and the thing is, you know, you can't stand still. You can't let other people be responsible for fundamentally what a sport is presenting to its public, be that the audience on TV or the people that are attending, fans, etc. They're presenting a brand, just the same as, you know, as commercial products are presenting a brand. And you can't let somebody else be responsible for your brand. You've got to own that, and you've got to take responsibility for how you present yourself. You let a TV sort of TV company present you. Well, all they'll really do is they'll present their broadcast of you. They'll try and get people watching it. That's fine. They've paid the money. But it's not necessarily saying anything about you as a sport, as a brand, as an entity. And it's not going to help you attract followers and fans that are passionate. So, yeah, there's a much greater level of depth to be gone into than purely just, yeah, we're on TV now.
Yeah, I mean, I would see that, you know, if you're looking at that, then you've got what's on the TV. You've got, obviously, the fan experience when they're actually at the game itself. And then you've got, obviously, the broadcast itself and you know, how that is sort of touching base with those who follow the game, but also those you're trying to pull in as well. So it's meshing all that together, isn't it, really?
Absolutely, yes. And there's an anecdote I came across from a sports marketing sort of conference last year, I think it was, when one of the digital marketeers for a particular sport stood up and was talking about how they were accessing their fans and what their reach was, and they said, if I have the opportunity to spend X amount of money on 10,000 hand flags, waving hand flags to distribute in the stadium, and a campaign that is going to get me access to that fan sitting on their sofa, triple screening, surfing the web and watching us on live on Facebook, and potentially get him off his seat and into our stadium, I know where I'm going to spend my money. And I thought, absolutely, I can understand that. That's all well and good. But when he gets there, you better still have spent the money on the 10,000 hand flags so that he has a good time when he's there, because otherwise he's not coming back. And I think people forget the digital thing has become sort of all encompassing and sort of as if it's the savior to everybody's problems, and the rest of it is still important. People's experience is one of the reasons that they love sport, you know, and you've got to look after that experience.
And one of the other things, again, that's become a key part of sport, of course, is sponsorship. And I've had sponsors say to me that they're not really sponsors today. They're more donors that they have got involved in the sport because they care about the sport, but their return on their investment is negligible. So, again, it's very important that there's got to be a way with the marketing that you're looking after your sponsor as well, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think that trend is actually at the top level is definitely going in the other direction. If you take most of the top leagues and the and sort of sophisticated sports and the way that they market themselves, they understand that the sponsors have a need. The sponsors are in it for a reason. They are looking to shift more product at the end of the day, whatever that product or service may be, and they're looking to their sponsorship to help them achieve that. And the smart rights holders are the ones that look at their sponsors and say, how can I help them achieve their goals? And that's not just a necessarily badging exercise. Sometimes it is. Sometimes a sponsor just wants extra exposure, eyeballs, bit of recognition. That might be all. But that's becoming less and less common, almost to the point of non-existence these days. Sponsors want measurable returns, and it's up to the rights holders, if you want to keep attracting those sponsors, to show how they can achieve them.
I mean, I look at one brand that your company is involved in, which is HSBC, who have, to me, intrinsically now are linked to the World Sevens Rugby Tour. I mean, how difficult was it to get that link and to get it to be so strong?
Well, I guess time is one of the factors. They've been doing it for a while now, but the surreal strength of that is how broadly they market it. You know, that has an impact on pretty much every part of their operations. They produce TVCs around it. They produce online content. They do huge staff engagement programs. Their at-match benefits and recognition are very strong. They police their rights quite strongly. So they ensure that when people are mentioning the tournament, it is mentioned in the correct way, that the sponsor is given their correct sort of designation and that sort of thing. All of those things. But to do that requires, you know, a significant number of resources on the HSBC side, and the entirety of sort of a team on our side as an agency to service them, you know, and we have teams going out to every event, prepping every event and ensuring that those rights are being adequately delivered. You're dealing with lots of different host unions. You're dealing with lots of different venues, different stadiums. You know, there's so many complexities in there that, yeah, how does it work? It works through a lot of sweat and concentration and attention to detail, I suppose.
I can imagine that we've got hopefully listeners from second tier sports who are thinking, wow, if it's going to take that sort of manpower, there's no chance for us to ever match that. I mean, how would a second tier sport, you know, outside of say football, rugby union, F1 or something like that, how are they going to possibly compete?
there's so many, there's a whole range of different approaches, I suppose. There's a lot of creativity these days, where you hear of sports finding a different way to market themselves, finding a bit of a niche. There's talk of, obviously, different, broadcast sort of arrangements, people that are signing up deals with, solely with mobile providers, solely online, Facebook, etc. So that's one way of sort of getting out there. I think one of my general points is that it's really hard for a sort of second tier sport necessarily to understand that full marketplace. So the first thing they probably should do is get professional advice, you know, pay, even if it's as an exploratory piece or an advisory piece, pay an agency to get you the best possible sort of channels, and be open to getting bad news as well as good. You know, don't, if you hear of people you know, pushing an agency to give them a very positive evaluation or giving them an overestimation of the worth of their rights, because that's the good news they want to hear, and then they don't actually manage to achieve those values commercially. So be realistic. Assume that you don't know everything and that there are other people out there that can help you, and sort of approach them. But definitely the creative, and unusual thinking out of the box type approach. I have heard of one, I've checked it out on the internet recently, but something like, what's it called? Extreme E, which is going to be a follow up to the Formula E, electric racing series, and it's being done by electric SUVs, but they're not broadcasting it live. They're actually going to keep the results all secret and then serialize it via Netflix or something like that, so that it will become effectively a genuine sporting documentary drama with plot twists, etc., being released each week as the season progresses. And I kind of go, that's thinking differently.
Yeah, that's really clever. That is different. I mean, before we started, obviously, this conversation today, I mean, you were saying one of the things that is almost, if you get into that space, you're really in trouble, is losing that fan focus, remembering why you're there, and that at the end of the day, sport is for the fans.
Absolutely. And I think, a client that's very close to our heart. We've been doing a lot of work with Cricket Australia this last year, and hopefully carrying on into the sort of next few years for that. They very publicly have gone through a review of the culture, et cetera, and it was felt that they were losing touch a little bit with their fan base, and it's really noticeable to see that they, as a big organization with reasonable, you know, with significant funds and expertise behind them, have adopted a mentality shift that is putting the fan at the center of what they're doing to try and, you know, gain back that confidence, gain back that trust from the supporter base. A team is nothing without the fans. A sport is nothing without the fans. They ultimately make or break everything. So if you start losing focus on why you're here, and you're more focusing more on the money, or maybe on on performance against all odds, or at any cost, it's not the right place to be. And the fans will let you know ultimately. They can be very loyal, but they can also be quite fickle.
Yeah, and I mean the other thing that the sort of dawn of the social media era, I think, has done is it has alienated some fans, because there are some fans that are not going into that space, and so those sports that have put a massive focus on that are actually losing a section of their market. Have you found that as well to be the case, that social media can actually alienate people as well?
I suppose possibly. I think treated properly, social media should be an ad rather than, it shouldn't allow something to be missed out or detract from. It should do all the, you should have all the things that you've been doing up to that point, and then you should give people additional access, additional value through the use of the social channels. Coming from a sort of an at venue and branding background originally, sort of, I always sort of tend to ask that question and sort of say, guys, you can't just, it's not all about the digital. What about the people that are just, you know, just going to the match? You know, how are they being looked after? How is their experience? And you might think it's not particularly important to dress your stadium nicely, to present it well, to have good signage telling people where to go, to just make that, you know, have good food offerings, etc. You might not think that is as important, but ultimately that's people's experience of the sport, and those are your, you know, again, not many people will tune in to watch it played in an empty stadium. So look after those guys, look after your atmosphere, look after your core supporter base. Yeah, I suppose they can get left behind a little bit if they are not not following what should be like the extra info, you know, the behind the scenes video, the online promotion, giving people sort of money can't buy opportunities and things like that. So I think, yeah, it's worth making sure that some of those things are made available slightly more widely. But it's a pretty sort of it's a pretty small niche now that isn't on social, to be honest. So, you know, you're getting most of them.
Yeah, I mean, I want to go back just quickly to Cricket Australia, because obviously you faced a major challenge after sort of all of the review that they did. And the one thing I thought that was really good this summer was the fact that you almost sort of branded all of the different formats of the game separately, but you really elevated the women's game, and it seemed to suddenly get sort of coverage, not just media coverage, but it just stood out as a standalone product, and it wasn't just tacked onto the men's game. Was that a conscious thing that you were trying to do?
So I think it was something that Cricket Australia were definitely focusing on. Obviously, there's with the women's and men's 2020 World Cups coming up next year. There's a feeling that, you know, you've got two World Cups, they're at opposite ends of the year, but you don't want to see a differentiation. You want to see them treated in much the same way. And I think they have a huge opportunity there to set real new benchmarks for women's sports viewership with that 2020 World Cup sort of early next year. In terms of the way that we were approached for things, we were generally focusing on the men's, but it was noticeable, I think, as the women's sort of tournaments were running, that they were asking for additional things, that they wanted to elevate those women's matches as well. It was sometimes a little bit sort of it was a bit ad hoc. Maybe it hadn't been planned out as far in advance, but definitely the results, you know, were impressive. We put out a huge amount of extra branding in the lead up to the Women's Big Bash final, and that resulted in really good attendance and fantastic atmosphere. So that was a big sort of positive for them. And yeah, I think it's definitely going in the right direction. The way that the men's sort of team as well, I think, sort of looked after all of the different codes in terms of, or the different sort of formats of the game, was quite sort of surprising that they'd sort of, you know, they gave full attention to all of those sort of codes to really sort of try and elevate them. And I mean, from what we were doing for them particularly, it was just about improving that spectator environment and just building a little bit of atmosphere and stuff like that as people are arriving at the ground and sort of getting behind the team. So yeah, I think they were quite pleased with how it went, and we're hopefully, you know, there'll be bigger and better things to come in sort of future years. Obviously it'll all come down to the Ashes in a few years time, and my loyalties will definitely be probably on the other side on that one.
Mine too, so don't worry about that. Look, Sam, I could probably talk to you for a lot longer, but I'm going to let you go, and also we've got a sort of time limit as well. But just one thing, I mean, if you were going to sort of encapsulate what we've discussed and try and sort of put it in brief, what would be a short bit of advice that you would give people looking to market their sport?
To the smaller sports, recognize that marketing is complicated and getting increasingly more complicated year on year. So seek the best advice and look to be diverse. Don't think that you can know all of it. You're not expected to. To the larger sports, don't get sort of sucked in by the bright lights of digital, I suppose. You know, remember the fans, remember the at-ground experience, and that all of those things are still important. Enhance and amplify, but don't sort of don't forget anything.
Look, Sam, fantastic talking to you. Thank you so much for your time, and hopefully we talk again in the future.
Appreciate it. Thanks very much. Good to speak to you, Ashley.
Hi, I'm Derek Underwood, and this is the Not the Footy Show.
Yes, it is indeed Not the Footy Show. Was that played for any specific region just because Sam was saying he was supporting England in the Ashes there, John?
We're coming after you. We're coming after you, Sam.
Hey,
don't
I'm
worry.
With Sam. It's the one team I can't support after all these years. Still got to stick with the English cricket
Steve
team.
Smith and Dave Warner are going to have averages of 120.
Well, we won't go down that path. But look, I thought that was really interesting conversation with Sam. And I think, to me, one of the key points that he mentioned there is whether you're a sporting team, whether you're a sporting body, if you lose that fan focus, your marketing will fail. And the fact that he said, you know, when you promote it, when they get to the stadium, you've got to make sure you give them an experience. And again, that probably goes back to what we were talking about before with the coaching. If you're going to play mundane football or mundane hockey, you're not going to get them back. Even if they play the best music and your halftime entertainment's fantastic, it's the whole package nowadays. It's not just going to watch the game.
Your core product is obviously the sport that's being played. And so you've got to have a reasonable eye on making sure that that product is of a certain standard. But without all that other stuff, I mean, I know you hate the music at the Pro League.
Oh, I do. I detest it.
But I get why it's there. I understand it.
My issue with the music is I think there are sports where it works and there are sports where it doesn't work. Yeah. But if you're going to do it, there's two things. I don't have a problem with it when it's done really well. So you say I don't like it at the Pro League because the games I've been at, it's been rubbish music being played, but it's just not even creating an atmosphere. It's just kind of there. Whereas when they had the Hockey World League in Belgium, and they also had the Hockey World League finals in Raipur, they flew this Belgian DJ out, who was brilliant. I mean, he had the stands rocking like it is, I presume, because I've never gone to a T20 game, but how it would be at a T20 game and how it is at the basketball. And I have gone to the basketball and they do it very, very well.
Yeah.
And I just think that if you're going to do it, it's again pretty much what Sam says. You've got to get the best people in to do it to make sure that it's done properly so that it works and it has the positive impact that you want.
Is there room for, say, a sport like hockey to move 11-a-side into an indoor arena?
I think definitely,
yes. I mean, a lot of the sports you're talking about, like basketball, it's in an indoor arena, and that sort of atmosphere is far easier to create. When you go to a hockey field, it's a big open, it's a big field for a start. It's a big expanse.
Yeah, cricket feels bigger, but what I think needs to be done, if you're looking at it from a hockey, is to create that atmosphere. You're doing it at night, it makes a hell of a difference.
Oh, and we've been having this discussion in hockey about the Pro League too. It is so much more of a spectacle at night.
Yeah, but I also think, you know, growing up watching, you know, football in the UK, I always preferred going to a night game. Like, it was just a completely different vibe. It was just different, and you felt closer to the action, funnily enough.
And you know what it would make, say, in an FA Cup scenario, it makes that daytime game a little bit special because it is it sort of reinforces the history of the, you know, we play it at 2 o'clock, we play all the other games at night, whatever, but we're playing this at 2 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon because that's the time we always play it. We always have played it.
3 o'clock, maybe.
Three or whatever it is, but it gives you that little link of history, I think people still love that in sport. I think there's too many sports that throw away.
Oh yeah.
That, you know, historical stuff.
Traditions.
Traditions. Yeah. That's the word I'm looking for.
I think most fans as well like a routine, and I've spoken to a lot of fans who hate the fact now that games are not on a set day. And if you look at the Glory when they used to get the big crowds, and they did very well to get a good crowd the other week, and I must credit them actually with good marketing, because it's the first time I've actually seen in shops posters for the games. Now, so big pat on the back, because that's the first time they've done something that's actually gone out there to try and drive traffic through the gate. So I say well done to them for that. So when they used to get those crowds, the kickoff times, everybody knew when they were, that they were on a Sunday at a set time, and everybody had their routine. They would do whatever they had to do at home. They would then go to the Brisbane Hotel. They would then go to the Queen's Hotel, and they would make their way to the stadium. And it was, the routine was there. And I think the fact that you're chopping and changing the days of games, so sometimes it's a Friday night, sometimes it's a Saturday. The time, the kickoff times on a Saturday can vary depending on when the TV station wants them. Then they're on a Sunday. That has a massive effect, because fans can't plan around that. They like consistency. They like to know when the games are.
I think one of the biggest issues facing all sports is fixturing. And because without the fixturing, if you don't get the fixturing right, you can market things to blue in the face. And we see it in the Pro League. The fixtures are all over the shop. Australia's not playing, men or women, are not going to play for over a month. And you lose traction. When you lose that continuity, people lose interest.
I've commentated all the Australian games and the New Zealand games, and
they're not playing another game in the country.
Australia won't now until next year. Yeah.
Yeah. So, for Australian fans.
But I found it even very difficult without actually looking up on my notes when the games are, because there's nothing. I'm not getting any email alerts from anybody telling me that there's a game coming up today. And that's the FIH. It's their competition. They send you match reports after the game's taken place. They don't say coming up this weekend is this. And I don't go on their website every day to look for news and whatever. And it's like, and I don't get emails from, and I get emails from a lot of the countries that are participating from their media departments. And again, nobody's sending out. So it needs something to prompt you to go, oh, there's a game tonight. I need to watch that.
Yeah. And people do like, the regular certainty of these things. I mean, that's why club competitions in a lot of sports work, because 1 week you're away, 1 week they're going to be home. We're going to be able to go down there, and then, you know, you have an away game, so you can go off and do the gardening with the missus, or the next week they're back, this is what we're doing. Look, let's not kid ourselves about how hard fixturing is in the modern sports era, especially when you've got television stations breathing down your neck, telling you, we want content, and this is the times we want the content. And let's face it, television stations aren't really that interested in the growth of your sport necessarily, or the welfare of the fans. They're interested in putting bums on seats in front of televisions. And there's nothing worse than watching a highly professional game of sport with three people in the stands. That's one of the things that kills Test cricket.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's interesting, the comment you make there is, you know, TV don't care, you're saying about that. But then if you look now how many sporting events are actually played on delay on TV, you're going, well, then why are they so worried about the kickoff times if they're going to show the game delayed anyway? So surely the sports could actually turn around now and say, well, you've only shown X amount of our games live. You've shown X amount of them on delay. So surely when we play them doesn't really matter, because you're playing more of them on delay. So we want to start this time. You can play them all on delay.
And of course, if you've got the rights to a certain product, it's always a good idea to show it and to market the fact that you're showing it. Now, we've had a recent Euro EPO for the Sultan Aslan Shah. Now, we had a situation where in India, the broadcaster in India didn't want to buy the rights, which is their prerogative. It's a free market economy and all those sorts of things. So they didn't get to see it. Us here in Australia, our broadcaster Fox did buy the rights, but then A, didn't show the games live, showed them on replay the next morning or 3 days later at early time slots, and didn't tell anybody. So a lot of hockey followers in this country were going, well, where can we see it? Can we stream it? Across the globe, this must be said. How can we watch it? There's a perfect opportunity for Fox to go, oh, well, look, sorry, we can't show them live because, you know, we've got other programming, but you can watch these games at this time on this day that we are going to be showing. We've bought the rights from. I can't imagine why you would pay a big sum of money to buy the rights for a sport and then not promote you are going to show it. I mean, no one knew that Fox had it on. They did. They said nothing about it.
That's baffling.
It staggers me that that's, and it ponders the question of why would you do that? And it's a bit of the Greg Evans clause if you contract.
You love that one.
I do, because television stations do that. They buy content so that it can't be shown on other networks, as opposed to actually having a genuine desire to show that content on their own network. It happens.
Yeah, it's a shame because it was a really good tournament as well.
And they put a lot of effort into the broadcast, I believe. This would have been a very good hockey broadcast from a technical point of view. We would have gone, wow, these guys are doing well.
Well, I have to say that one former Australian, I won't say who, came up to me and said that they thought it was the best coverage of hockey they'd seen from that perspective, that the TV camera angles, how close they got to the action and everything. So that was nice, and I've passed that feedback on to all the crew back in Malaysia.
Yeah, well, I'm sad that I missed out on it. I would have loved to have seen it. Especially as how in the Pro League there were no games on. It was almost like they'd set aside this window where the Sultan of Aslan could happen, and then no one got to see any of the games, unless you're in Malaysia.
Yeah, I think, I mean, look, I thought it was a really good tournament. Obviously, a lot of the big nations that are in the Pro League didn't participate this time, which was a shame, but at the same time, it was good because it meant the games were a lot more even. You know, Poland were there for the first time ever. They were a late inclusion when South Africa pulled out because they didn't have the funds to be able to get there. But saying that, Poland were, you know, again, you look at this, John, and this is what worries me sometimes, is Poland, clearly, you could see, if they got more games, if they got more opportunity, would be a really not a bad side. They had real determination, some good skills, but they'd just come out of winter. They'd been playing indoors, and suddenly they were in temperatures where the humidity on some days was 85%. It was stifling. And they had two of the 4 o'clock games. And in the last day, they were beating Japan in their wooden spoon game, 1-0. Start of the last quarter, you literally saw they'd hit a wall. They had nothing left. And they conceded 6 in the last quarter, which was crazy. But it was unfair because it wasn't a fair reflection on the game, where they completely, in my opinion, bossed the first three quarters, or certainly not looked troubled, and then they literally just ran out of legs. But as their coach was saying, you know, it'll do them good when they're preparing for the hockey series finals, and, you know, they really were grateful for the opportunity, and the players absolutely loved it, and that's what it's about.
If you look back to the Women's World Cup in London, the Netherlands were by far and away the best team in the tournament, no doubt there. And what's interesting is that Australia were the only team that really took it to the Netherlands. But they're one of the few teams that plays the Netherlands regularly. Now, the Australian girls knew all about the Netherlands team. They played them a few times, blah, blah, blah. And they got close. They nearly knocked them off. I think penalty shootout.
Went to a shootout. Went not to a penalty shootout. Just a shootout.
Yeah. These technical terms. Then the Dutch followed up against the Spanish in the final.
Ireland in the final.
Ireland in the final. Sorry, yeah, the Spanish beat Australia. The Irish haven't played the Dutch in years. They couldn't get a game. The Dutch basically didn't want to play against
the
Irish.
That was the quote of the tournament, wasn't it? Yeah. Graham Shaw saying, I've been trying to get a game against them for years. Now they've got to play us.
Yeah. But what you saw there was a team that that weren't ready. I tell you what, if they had played 2 days later, the Irish would have got closer to them, would have got a lot closer.
Oh, absolutely, but maybe that's why Alison Annan didn't want to play them.
Well, you know, yeah, I don't think she's that forward-thinking. But the idea that when these lower-ranked teams, like Poland, get exposure to that, they've improved really, really quickly. But when they're in a one-off game against a real powerhouse team, they're going to get flogged.
Not that the Irish got flogged.
Yeah. And I know it just from playing in our lowly grade. We come up against a team we haven't played before, and they beat us 4-0. I know that's not going to be the scoreline next time around, because we're going to be ready for you. We know who the players are.
And if you're any good, you learn from those
experiences. Absolutely. Next time we play them, see that bloke there? Okay, you're going to mark him, and every time the ball goes to him, you're going to whack him in the ankles. You know, not literally, but that idea of how you take that player out, or you might go, that guy's really good at doing X, so we've got to play down the other wing. We've just got to keep the ball away from him. It's little things like that that you can pick up that, you know, you don't, unless you play against a team, you're never going to find those things out. You watch videotape for as long as it, but as a player, unless you get out there and experience it.
Nah, totally agree. Well, that's probably it, I think, for this show. Though we do have one last thing we want to say.
Yeah, we do, because of course, long-time listeners would know that this show originally started out with yourself and Darren Harper as the hosts.
Yeah, and congratulations to Darren. His podcast has been nominated for one of the top podcasts in Britain, so congratulations.
Oh, really?
Darren.
Is it a running podcast? Well done, Darren. Good stuff, mate.
But we were on 990 AM,
which was a station that predominantly did spoken word stuff, radio for the print handicapped, and predominantly volunteers who were working there. One of those volunteers was a gentleman by the name of Jack Greenway. And Jack was a long-time supporter of our program. He used to supply us with some material occasionally. He was a very, very strong supporter of our show. And a wonderful, wonderful gentleman. And sadly, Jack passed away a couple of days ago. And he'd been sick for a little while, so perhaps not a huge shock to people, but terribly, terribly sad. He was a fantastic gentleman and great sports lover.
And he had some great stories to tell about sport, watching it, playing it, whatever. He was a wonderful individual.
Very much of an icon of one of the amateur football clubs in Melbourne. Apparently, one of the walls in their clubhouse, he walked into it many years later, and there's this huge picture of him on the wall that shocked him quite. He was just a wonderful fella, and he'll sadly missed, and the memories of time spent with Jack will stay with me for a long time.
Yeah, and with me too, and our thoughts go out to him and his family, well, all his surviving family members, and thanks for the memories, Jack.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over. It is
over. See ya, we'll be back next week.